KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Coming up on the show, Attorney General Eric Holder wants to reform drug sentencing. We're going to have local reaction to his proposal. Plus, we put President Obama's comments on the NSA last week into perspective. But first, we're going to start with some KUOW news. And Weekday lead producer Katie Sewell joins me. Hello.
Hi, Marcy.
So, fall is coming up just a few weeks away. And, you know, a lot of folks start school. It's a time of new beginnings. The seasons change, the leaves change colors. And we have a new beginning of our own here at KUOW.
We do. We have a big announcement this morning. KUOW is going to join together the very talented staffs, if I do say so myself, of Weekday and The Conversation. And we're going to create a new show that's going to be co-hosted by Steve Scher, Ross Reynolds, and of course, by you, Marcy Silman.
We're calling the show The Record. And as with anything new in transition, we are moving. We're packing up our Weekday bags and we move from 9 a.m. The Record runs from noon to 2. Weekday is live all this week. And then we're going to celebrate the 20-year history of this show by dipping into the Weekday archives. We're going to be bringing you some real gems from the past over the next couple of weeks, starting the 19th.
So the sad news in all this is that a Weekday is coming to a close. But the great news is that the KUOW staff and the KUOW listeners, of course, are embarking on a new adventure, which we hope will be full of different discoveries that we haven't already done. And I'm thrilled with what we've already done, to be honest. And I'm so excited to see what's to come. And I think that's going to be so interesting to see you, Marcy, and Steve and Ross in a totally different light.
All in one place. And of course, not just Steve and Ross and I, but the regular guests that you love from Weekday are not, well, they're moving from 9 to noon, but they're not going anywhere. You're going to hear Nancy Pearl, the news of the week with Knute Berger, Joni Balter, and Eli Sanders. Katie, you're going to continue to delve back into the golden age of radio, but before you do some delving, you have a little news of your own to share.
I do. I am going to be filing those radio retrospectives from the other side of the world.
The world?
I know.
Oh my gosh.
I'm going to be in Rome. My husband Derek and I accepted a fellowship to study there for the next year, which was a very hard decision for me to make, Marcy, believe it or not, because, you know, KUOW listeners are about the smartest, most open-minded people I have ever known, and I love that they never stop learning, and I'm really going to miss working for them.
And we're going to miss having you here, but, you know, it's amazing. Technology brings us close across thousands and thousands of miles, so we'll be in touch with you.
Yeah, and Steve and I were a great team, and the new show is going to be great, too. I'm really going to miss seeing how it comes together, but I will be listening, and I hope that all of you listening will also keep in touch with me. I'll be doing things here and there. So if you want to email me at radiokatie@gmail.com.
That's Radio Katie, spelled K-A-T-Y, and you can keep up with Katie and her projects there. The rest of us will be on The Record starting September 3rd here on KUOW at 12 noon, and hope you'll be joining us too. From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Attorney General Eric Holder says it's time to rethink the stiff mandatory sentences imposed for some low-level drug crimes. In a speech he's scheduled for later this morning, Holder will call on prosecutors to omit listing quantities of illegal substances in some of these low-level drug case indictments. Holder hopes this will ease prison overcrowding, cut down on the very high costs of running our nation's prison, and correct what Holder sees as unfairness inherent in the justice system. Joining us now to talk about this is Mike McKay. He's former U.S. Attorney for Western Washington, now in private practice with the McKay-Chadwell Law Firm. And Mike McKay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
When we heard about the Attorney General's proposed changes, two things came to mind. One is first to get some idea of how much of our federal prison population is incarcerated on these low-level drug offenses.
Well, I don't have those numbers, there's clearly a very large federal prison population. And one way to look at it is to compare our rate with those rates throughout the world. United States has 5% of the world's population, and yet 25% of everyone in prison throughout the world is here in the United States. So it's certainly disproportionate, and there has to be a good reason for it. And I do think the Attorney General's review here is appropriate under the circumstances.
What do the mandatory sentences for drug offenses require?
Well, it depends on the charge, but Congress over the years, mostly in the 80s and the early 90s, passed a series of laws that required judges to send defendants away for mandatory minimums, 5 or 10 years in most cases, if certain facts exist and they're charged in the indictment. And so as a result, a lot of people went to prison for where the judge had no discretion for 5 or 10 years if, a certain amount of drugs were involved or guns were involved and so forth. And as a result, we have a lot of people in prison in the wake of that legislation.
And was it dependent on the type of drug that was involved in the offense?
Sometimes, but it's mostly the amount. And so the more drugs, if you hit a certain threshold, and it's set forth clearly both in the federal law as well as the sentencing guidelines, then that person is gone for that mandatory minimum. The judge has no discretion. If the jury makes the finding, then the judge has to send that person away for at least that amount of time.
So you mentioned these are laws that Congress made. The Attorney General is proposing something that would, I don't want to say go around Congress, but it would definitely be a little more direct than having a bill proposed in two houses of the federal legislatures.
It's always better to work with Congress when changes of this nature take place. But in many ways, prosecutors make these decisions every day. It's just that it's not announced in a speech to the American Bar Association. Prosecutors, assistant U.S. attorneys and U.S. attorneys make these decisions every day. When a case comes across their desk, they look at it, they look at the facts, then they make a decision. Am I going to put the amount of drugs in the indictment or not? And sometimes they exercise their discretion, even though there are policies otherwise, to not put it in there, and the mandatory minimums would not be forced upon the judges. There are no press releases about that, but it happens every day. So I would have liked to have seen them go to Congress with this, because there's broad bipartisan support for this kind of change. It's been very successfully implemented in Texas, for instance, a fairly conservative state, and I suspect there'd be broad bipartisan support for this idea.
When we talk about the costs of running our federal prisons at this point, are we talking, would you think that this would significantly cut if we didn't sentence a certain proportion of drug offenses? Would that make a significant dent in the high cost of running prisons?
It would certainly reduce the expenses. It depends on what you mean by significant. I believe it would, because we're talking about low-level folks. There are a lot of them, and a lot of them, depending on the district throughout the country, who had been going away for those mandatory minimum periods of time. So, yes, I do think it would reduce the cost, and it's really time, because currently we have nearly 20,000 people in the federal system, and that's 40% above our official capacity. So either A, we need to reduce the population, or B, build more facilities. And I'm just not entirely sure we can afford that.
We're talking with former U.S. Attorney for Western District of Washington, Mike McKay. The Attorney General is also talking about shifting a portion of these cases from the federal to the state courts. Is that even possible?
It certainly is, and normally that requires some close relationships, good communication with local law enforcement, and that happens on a district-by-district basis. I know when I was the United States Attorney, I worked very closely with King County Prosecutor Norm Mailing and the other local prosecutors to discuss this very thing. And I know our current U.S. Attorney, Jenny Durkin, works very closely with King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg. Indeed, they were in the same law school class. And I'm sure she works with other prosecutors throughout the district to address these kinds of questions. And so all what's happening here is the Attorney General is addressing it on a national basis. It's probably a good idea. I think the larger cases should be addressed by the feds because they can send these people away for longer periods of time. I think it sounds like the Attorney General is just employing the appropriate kind of discretion and making sure that the focus is on those that should be receiving federal focus, and that is the big, heavy dealers and not the low-level street dealers and consumers.
In fact, there are a number of caveats, including not just the large dealers, but also whether there's gun violence involved. There's a whole list of criteria that a prosecutor would have to look at before omitting the amount of drugs that were involved. So this isn't then another question I had about the transfer of cases. On the face of it, it would seem that, you know, if we're talking about the high cost of the justice system, transferring cases to state jurisdictions also means transferring costs from one to the other, doesn't it?
It certainly does, and that's why they need to, local law enforcement needs to continue to communicate with the federal law enforcement leaders, as they have certainly in this district for many decades. And it could very well be, as part of those communications, a continued shifting from local to federal, those larger dealers who are currently being addressed by local law enforcement. They should be sent up to the feds and have them handle it. So it's that kind of give and take that I think is really to the benefit of the citizens of our community, that kind of a close working relationship.
This is, as you mentioned, it's not every day that this kind of policy is announced in a press release and made public in a speech to the American Bar Association. Does that mean that it can take effect immediately?
I believe it is taking effect immediately. The Attorney General issued an order to the U.S. attorneys effective today, or they received it today. I don't know what the effect date is, but since it is an executive decision rather than a congressional act, I believe they can implement it any time, and I suspect they're doing it as soon as possible, which could be this week.
Well, just the last question, and this is more specific to Washington State. At the state level, officials have been waiting for quite some time for Mr. Holder's office to respond for clarification when it comes to our new laws regarding marijuana possession and use. This does not mention that at all. As far as I know, the Attorney General hasn't responded. Can you extrapolate from what he said today about drug offenses to what he might have in store in mind, at least when it comes to the federal stance to Washington State and Colorado's new laws?
I can't. But it is shameful that the citizens of Washington State and Colorado have voted for the legalization of certain kinds of marijuana use, and now, in the middle of August, 9 or 10 months later, the Department of Justice still, even after requests from the governors of those states and the senators from those states, still has not given guidance to the states of Washington and Colorado. I think it's shameful.
Mike McKay, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us this morning. Mike McKay is a former U.S. attorney for the Western District of Washington. He's now in private practice with McKay Chadwell Law Firm. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
KUOW 94.9. News and information, it's 9:21.
Support for KUOW comes from the Champion Window and Sunroom Company, manufacturing and installing custom factory direct windows since 1953. Champion Windows help keep homes warm in winter, cool in summer, and quiet year-round. In-home consultation and product and warranty information at championfactorydirect.com.
The University of Washington is run by a board of regents. One of those regents is a student, Kiana Scott. Ross Reynolds talks with her today at 12:35. 63 degrees, expecting a high today in the mid-70s, mostly cloudy this morning, gradually becoming mostly sunny this afternoon. Tonight, look for a low in the mid-50s with partly cloudy skies.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. At a news conference last Friday, President Obama vowed to implement reforms to the NSA's controversial surveillance program. At the same time, the White House released two very lengthy documents that outline further the administration's legal justifications for searching our emails and telephone calls. What were those arguments, and what specifically is the president proposing to make the NSA program more transparent? We're joined now by Joe Klock. He's a reporter for The Daily Dot. His work has appeared in Wired, Mother Jones, and Scientific American. Joe, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Sure thing.
The New York Times did report on Friday that the NSA has the ability to search emails and phone calls of individual Americans who are corresponding outside, either to another country or from another country, and that they can do that without a warrant. Until now, people thought that unwarranted searches only applied to foreigners or Americans communicating with foreigners outside the U.S. Is this a big revelation or a big policy change?
I think it's pretty hard to tell at this point, because essentially what was revealed is that all of these Americans that get swept up because they're communicating with someone abroad, their information, if it is deemed at the time that it's swept up to be potentially of national security importance, then apparently the agency saves it in a, to some degree, searchable database. But it's still unclear to what extent they're actually doing searches on that database. So the New York Times article does seem to indicate from an intelligence source that they're doing, to a certain extent, that they are querying that database. So I think at this point it's more of a almost ideological concern about whether they should have the ability to do it than an actual concern of whether they of the extent to which they're doing it.
The White House also, as I mentioned, released two very long documents that outline the administration's justification for collecting domestic telephone records. Can you talk about the gist of the Obama administration's legal argument?
Yeah, the gist of the argument seems to be, well, two things, really. The first is that they're doing very little of it, is what those documents seem to claim. For instance, I believe one of them said it was about 1.6% of Internet traffic was all that they were claiming to be monitoring. Of course, given the number of silly things on the Internet, that might be a significant amount of the important information moving across there. And the other thing would be their arguments also sort of talk about what right to privacy phone data has versus, say, car data. They talk about things like you don't have the same expectations of privacy when it comes to your GPS location as you might in a car, that sort of thing. But I think the broader point with those arguments is they're really, whether or not a lot of this stuff is technically legal seems almost beside the point, given the fact that, you know, the question I think that most people who have difficulties with this stuff are asking is whether it should be legal, whether it should be allowed. They're not looking for some sort of roundabout justification for why it technically is constitutional or legal.
So what you're talking about is that the Obama administration, in some sense, is arguing semantics about the letter of the law as opposed to the spirit of the Constitution?
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
The president also on Friday told reporters who were gathered at that press conference that he wanted to reform how the FISA courts operated by adding what he called an adversarial voice to the mix. First of all, how do the FISA courts work now when it comes to surveillance?
Well, now it's, as the White House would admit, it's pretty one-sided. It's just a revolving body of judges who go to this secretive, supposedly unlabeled courtroom, and they basically rule on warrants as to whether or not they should allow surveillance on a particular target. And historically, since 1978, when the court was created, there's been thousands and thousands of requests, and only, I believe it's 10, have ever been denied. So What you want to do with that information, I don't know, but it does seem to be pretty one-sided.
So what kind of adversarial voice is the president advocating that be added to this court?
Well, that at this point isn't entirely clear. So the speech was sufficiently vague that I think you could offer up any number of suggestions. You might say he's talking about a pool of attorneys, much like you have a pool of judges, and they would come in and defend individual requests. However, that seems unlikely, just given the volume, and conceivably many of these warrants are being requested for what are perceived as legitimate, possibly immediate threats of terrorism or that sort of thing. And in those cases, it seems unlikely that the administration would want to add a lengthy procedural judicial debate to that process. So I think what's more likely, and what the former NSA director, Michael Hayden, recently suggested, is that it's probably going to more involve questions of metadata, say, or data that's already been collected. Say, I think the example he gave was if they collected a bunch of metadata for one reason and then wanted to keep it or use it or search it for another reason and needed permission from the court, then the court would bring somebody in who could defend the, I guess, rights of the owners of those of that data. But I think that the latter example is probably more likely, just given the nature of why those proceedings exist.
We're talking with reporter Joe Klock, who works for the Daily Dot, among other publications. Joe, maybe you can explain. You said that the FISA court was set up a couple of decades ago, before the Patriot Act. What is the relationship between the Patriot Act and the court itself?
Well, it's really since 9/11. So to step back, the court has always been doing to some extent what we're talking about. And before the 2008 amendment to FISA, basically the court had the ability to surveil, they could surveil non-U.S. persons who were in the U.S. for up to 72 hours without a warrant. And then starting after 9/11, the court was given the ability to do cross-border surveillance where one of the persons could be a U.S. party. So the real change is it's Section 702 of the FISA Amendment, which now allows this cross-border surveillance, which in effect does sweep up the communications of U.S. citizens.
Now, leaving the court aside, the president also talked about plans to make some other reforms to make the NSA more transparent, in his words. What are those plans that the president talked about?
Well, similarly to the legal advocacy, they're pretty vague. One of them is to reform the FISA court, but there wasn't much information on what exactly that would mean. Another one offered was, I think he called them privacy officers, which would sort of be advocates for privacy at the level of the administration of these programs, I suppose inside the NSA, that sort of thing. So it would be someone who's on the procedural level who would be sort of advocating for the rights and being sort of a watchdog for the people who are being surveilled.
It's interesting the timing of this news conference on Friday, because if you have read coverage since the leaks became public earlier this summer, the president started off saying, well, they're really, people aren't listening to your telephone calls. There's really nothing to be worried about. And now he's clearly responding to public perception. Is that your opinion of why he had this press conference on Friday as well?
Certainly. I think the tactic of response seems to have very much changed given the public outrage, from being trying to brush this aside to trying to address the concerns that have been raised without admitting that Edward Snowden, who leaked this stuff, was right in doing so. And so I think they've probably just taken a long time to figure out exactly how to toe that line. But I think that's what this conference was.
But some critics of the NSA program and ongoing surveillance say that what the president did actually does vindicate what Edward Snowden did.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's kind of complicated because the way the president addressed these issues, he said that these are legitimate concerns and people are right to have them, but that there were legal ways to blow the whistle on these programs if people had concerns about them. And the difficult thing, I think, is figuring out whether or not had Snowden tried to do that, would he have been successful, or would he have been brushed off? Because in the past, I don't think it was through exactly the same procedures, but you did have, I think it was in 2006, NSA senior executive Thomas Drake. He, I believe, tried sort of through the system to point out reckless spending at the agency and reckless surveillance, really. And when that didn't work, he did end up blowing the whistle on them, and he was tried for espionage, though he was acquitted. So it's difficult. Theoretically, Obama's argument is, I think, a valid one, but it's hard to know at this point whether or not Snowden could have been successful if he had gone through the procedures that the president suggests.
Do you think that the administration's public reassurances about surveillance will have any influence on the public perceptions about what Snowden did?
I do. I think to some extent, the less they're willing to acknowledge that this is going on, the more suspicious people become, because intuitively, I think anybody who's fluent in the internet these days understands that so much of their data, I mean, just computers work by copying things and sending them and making new copies of them. So everyone sort of intuitively understands that this information almost will be collected unless we have procedures to stop it from being collected and laws to stop it. And so it rings really false when this stuff is revealed publicly and a debate starts happening and it gets outright denied. But I think the more it gets acknowledged, the more people begin to think about, can take seriously the responses of the administration, because the truth is probably that it's somewhere in between what our, you know, worst imagination 1984 style fears of this is and what the administration is saying it is. And so I think the more we have sort of pushback from both sides, the closer we'll get to the middle, which is probably where the reality of it is.
Joe, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Joe Klock is a reporter for The Daily Dot. He's been covering the NSA data mining and surveillance issues and President Obama's news conference last Friday. We'll be bringing you all the developments on that on this show and throughout the days here on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:35, KUOW 94.9. KUOW brings you a wide variety of programs every week. To see a list of all those different shows, go to KUOW.org and click on Programs.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at OurParksOurFuture.org.
64 degrees in the Seattle area currently. expecting a high today in the mid-70s. These clouds burning off, and we'll get mostly sunny skies this afternoon. Tonight's low temperature in the mid-50s, partly cloudy. Tuesday, a touch warmer, a high in the upper 70s. We'll have mostly sunny skies on Tuesday in the Seattle area.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. I confess, despite what my family sees as my pathological need to eat vegetables, grains, and fruits, every so often I want a salty fix, chips, french fries, and movie theater popcorn mixed with M&Ms, which is really my most disgusting junk food fix. I don't indulge in that all that often, but when I do, I aim for the very best. Junk food. You know that you probably have a secret craving somewhere in your past or your present. We want to know what it is. Give us a call at 206-543-5869 or 1-800-289-5869. Don't email us because we're having a little email issue. And so to talk about junk food, we bring only the best to the KUOW studios. Two food experts, and they are here to really weigh in on it, the definitive junk food definition and also the benediction to junk food, I think. Molly Weisenberg is creator of the blog Orangette, author of the memoir A Homemade Life, part of the family behind the dynasty of Delancey and Essex and The Pantry. And she's also the podcasting partner of our second guest, the equally esteemed Matthew Amster Burton. They host Spilled Milk together. But Matthew writes the blog Roots and Grubs, and he's an author of a new book called Pretty Good, Number One, An American Family Eats Tokyo. And it's great to see you once again. It's been a while since we've had you in here.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so definitively, what is junk food?
Oh, wow. Matthew, take it away.
Well, I think we were talking about this earlier, and it's sort of like, it's not quite food. It's like the food equivalent of a toy. You know, it has no real value in and of itself except to make us happy. And if you confuse it with nutrition, then you're sort of coming at it from the wrong angle, I think.
Okay, so it has no nutritional value. Is that one tenet of junk food?
I think so.
I feel like, it's fun to eat. I would say that for me is the defining thing. I don't go to it when I'm hungry or looking to have a meal. I go to it when I'm looking for something delicious to put in my mouth, period.
So when... You know, we've heard a lot about nutrition, and I know we're not supposed to talk about that, but one of the things that they say when we don't get enough sleep, for example, that we crave sugar and fat and salt, which seem to me to be three main components of junk food. Sugar, fat, salt?
Yeah, mm-hmm. you can sort of use those three things to create a lot of food-like things that are delicious to put in your mouth using very few other ingredients.
Well, you brought one of my favorite junk foods, and it's amazing how many I like when I sat down to think about this.
Oh, yes.
And so before we hold up the blue bag and the chemicals within, listeners are probably freaking out. It's okay. You can be semi-anonymous. You can go by a first name or a pseudonym if you want to call 206-543-5869. And I think that oven-roasted kale chips are not junk food.
No. Yeah, I mean, I think what we're talking about here are sort of well-engineered food-like products.
Okay. I see over my computer, rattle it, Matthew. Hold it right up. Yeah, so cellophane. Oh, no, he opened it. He's just opened Cool Ranch Doritos.
Oh, smell that.
We don't have Smell-O-Rama here. I wish that we did. I don't know that there is one real ingredient in Cool Ranch Doritos, and yet they are incredibly fun to eat. Why is that?
Oh, they are. They're wonderfully crispy. They have this, may I say, gorgeous multicolored confetti of flavoring on them.
It is a rainbow.
And they actually have this wonderful buttermilk-like tang to them. I mean, they are, I think Cool Ranch Doritos are the perfect junk food.
I think they actually have dried buttermilk almond in them.
I think so,
oh,
yeah.
Wow,
somehow.
Real buttermilk.
Yeah, well, real? I don't know. Okay. Are these dried substances real? I don't actually know, which brings a question to mind about the possibility of organic junk food. Like, I go, like many people, to the local food co-ops where they purvey organic foods. And there are shelves now mm-hmm. of things that I call junk food, like cheese puffs and pirate booty, which I think is junk food.
And, oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. And so does that count?
Well, okay, so a junk food that I know Matthew and I both love are Reese's Peanut Butter Cups.
Oh, yes.
And I know that Newman's Organics, makes their version, and it's delicious.
Yeah.
For me, it doesn't quite have there's a certain junky je ne sais quoi about the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup that just, it really tastes bad for you, and I think that that's important. That's not to say that I don't buy the Newman's kind, too.
When you want to feel healthy.
When I want to feel a little healthier about having some junk food.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to be eating junk food and be sort of straddling this line of like, you know, could this be kind of good for me? I think that puts you in the wrong mindset to really enjoy it the way it was meant to be enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. We're talking junk food, believe it or not, after talking about health and nutrition and high cuisine with these two guests, Matthew Amster-Burton and Molly Weisenberg. We want to hear from you, and some of you have already called 206-543-5869 or toll-free 1-800-289-5869. So Molly loves Cool Ranch Doritos. Matthew, is this on the top of your list as well?
Oh, we absolutely share that love. I also brought along Sour Patch Watermelon Slices. Ugh. That's another one of our favorites. You know, our show, we kind of half the time eat real food and half the time eat junk food on the show. And so, you know, when we're eating real food, we'll get people emailing saying, do more junk food episodes and vice versa.
So this is the live radio version of that. I know
exactly.
That you two recently had an in-depth conversation about East Coast potato chips.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we did.
And mm-hmm. I want you to talk about the difference between an East Coast and a West Coast potato chip.
That's a good question. We had a listener who, we always call them readers.
That's because you're writers.
We had a listener who sent us a huge box of potato chips. It was so generous and so inconducive to good eating, to healthy eating. So we busted open this huge box of potato chips. I think, you know, they kind of take their potato chips a little more seriously overall and have for a long time on the East Coast. So there's these venerable brands like Hers and Utz. And which are, you know, fun to say and fun to eat and available in an incredible array of flavors.
I feel like there's a long tradition of good kettle cooked chips on the East Coast.
But, you know, when you look at potato chips, many of them are just potatoes, oil and salt, which, you know, those aren't. It's not full of the kinds of things that are on the back of those Cool Ranch Doritos, which I gesture to because I actually want to start eating them now, which is a horrible thing to say. But we'd love to bring some listeners into this conversation about junk food. But in one second, because Matthew, you wrote a whole book about eating in Japan. So
I did. And
I know that the Japanese have junk food.
Oh, yes.
And so is there a favorite that you and your co-eater, Irish, your daughter, ferreted out there?
Oh, the Japanese junk food is just, they take it to another level, both in terms of quality and in terms of the array of stuff available. So if something in Japan says, you know, cheese flavor, it is not going to taste like fake cheese. One of our favorite things was these crackers meant to be enjoyed with beer called Cheeza. And on the package, it has a percentage like a fancy chocolate bar, but the percentage is telling you what the percent of actual cheese is in the product. And so we would buy these 53% cheddar Cheeza crackers, and they look like little wedges of Swiss cheese, and they are the most intensely cheesy crackers. Like, you know, these things would put goldfish out of business if they came over to America.
Now, Molly, your daughter is about a year old now?
Mm-hmm.
Is
almost.
Almost a year old. So she probably is not yet eating junk food.
She is not.
You should let her go whole hog on a bag of Cool Ranch Doritos.
She's more like into, you know, roasted sweet potato and like plain yogurt and stuff.
You know, it's hard. You can't really keep them away from it. I'm speaking from experience.
Oh, no.
Goldfish are the threshold drug.
Oh, absolutely. They are the gateway drug. Like, once you get them on the goldfish, you're like, yeah, you know, a Dorito, that's not so different from a goldfish.
Or maybe it is. Listeners, 206-543-5869. And Irene from Montlake Terrace, you want to bring up an American icon of junk food.
Yes. The American icon of junk food, which I was not allowed to eat when I was growing up and didn't allow my daughter to eat it, are Twinkies.
Oh,
I was so upset when I heard that Twinkies was on its way out. I guess maybe it was that longing that I always had for them. But I was so pleased when I heard that they were saved. And I just think that they are an American icon junk food.
How old were you when you first got to eat it, since you weren't allowed to eat it when you were at home?
Well, you know, actually, I think probably I've had maybe one or half of the Twinkie since I've been an adult.
Yeah.
You know? Because I really wasn't allowed to. And, of course, I bringing up my daughter was kind of like one of your guests. I mean, it was all organic. Or I'm a co-op kind of person. But I don't know. There's just something about the color and the squishy middle. And yeah, I guess maybe the marketing of Twinkies, that was just so iconic. I just think it's just the iconic American all-time junk food.
Well, I believe that you are right, Irene. And thank you for your call. As you mentioned, they tried to remove them, and then they were resurrected by popular demand.
Oh, yeah,
demand.
They're like a zombie. You can't kill them.
Well, in fact, you could probably keep them forever because I'm not sure that there's an expiration date. I had their cousin, the Snowball, that was what it was called, on my desk for a really long time that somebody had given me that was turquoise.
Using it like as a paperweight and leaving a big grease stain on the paper.
No, it was wrapped. It was wrapped. It was in its cellophane package. It was just pretty.
You know, when I think about Twinkies, I don't often get a genuine Twinkie craving, but I sort of want to take a Twinkie out of the package and squeeze it in my fist and see what happens.
I had a babysitter named Virginia Hamilton. May she rest in peace. She was my Twinkie enabler when I was a kid. She would come to babysit and she would bring me a Twinkie because I wasn't allowed to have them. And you better believe it. I mean, I think that's why I remember her name to this day. Virginia, what a woman.
I once convinced a babysitter that my mother would let me eat like one of those giant cooking-sized Hershey bars. And so like I, you know, climbed up into the cupboard and ate like half of one of these things, got sick. I think this might account for my reasonably healthy relationship with junk food today, that I don't want to feel as sick as I felt after eating that enormous chocolate bar again.
It would do that. Ours was Jiffy Pop. I don't even know if that exists anymore, which was popcorn in its own, you know, I grew up in the era of TV dinners. So this was popcorn and it's sealed hermetically. There's probably oil in there, I'm assuming, and you shook it on the stove. So that actually wasn't all that bad for you. Twinkies are better in the imagination, I think, than when you actually taste them. So we want to know, listeners, Molly Weisenberg and Matthew Amster-Burton are here. It's time. Confess it. There is a junk food in your past, present, or future. What is it when you think junk food? And also, when do you eat it? Hi, Emily and Madrona. Thanks for holding. Your junk food of choice?
Is a crunchy candy bar from Canada. And you can't get them. And so my friends always bring them back when they cross the border, and I'm so obsessed with them that I wrote a poem and a letter to the company thinking they'd send me a free case.
Do you have the poem? Do you have the poem with you?
Unfortunately not.
No. So is Crunchy the name of the candy bar itself?
Yes, it's a Cadbury bar called Crunchy.
Oh,
it's
yes.
Like Seafoam, but Seafoam is poor substitute.
My favorite Canadian candy bar is the Mint Aero bar. I will bring a few of those back from Canada anytime I go.
Cadbury products from Canada and the UK are really quite good. I feel like that you can really taste the milk in the milk chocolate.
Well,
yes.
And you like the airy center of the crunchiness? Is that what it's made out of? That kind of, I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I think it is the airy crunchiness, just crunch itself, but it then kind of melts in your mouth, the crunchiness turns into kind of a solid.
Yeah, I've heard that from bars from those slightly colder countries like Canada and England have a lower melting point because they can get away with that. And so when they get into your mouth, they start to melt a little faster and a little more evenly, and that accounts for their amazing texture.
Okay,
so global warming hasn't hit candy bars yet.
All right, so all of Emily and Madrona's friends, you know what she wants as a gift. Thanks for calling in. So Matthew, you just explained the real culinary is not the right word, the scientific reason for how this candy bar stays in her mouth a certain way.
I guess so, yeah.
Or were you making that up?
Somebody once said that to me. I don't know if it's actually true.
We're talking junk food with two people who write and talk about food for a living, Matthew Amster-Burton, Molly Weisenberg. And Molly, I have made many of your recipes, and some of them I might characterize as aspiring to satisfy the craving that junk food just can't. There was a candy corn recipe that you had once, and I failed because I didn't remove all the seeds, so I almost cracked a tooth open.
Oh, no.
But I would say that candy corn is a type of junk food, which leads to the question, can one recreate with wonderful ingredients the junk food experience?
Well, so actually, I have a very good friend, Brandy Henderson, who's the owner of The Pantry, and she's the pastry chef at our restaurants, Delancey and Essex. And she, when I first met her, she was very into recreating all kinds of candy bars. She has made, you know, the little tiny candy corn that you get at Halloween?
Yes.
She has made those at home. You know, they have like three different colors. I don't even know how she does it. She has made, you know, little versions of Snickers bars. And it's all wonderful. I mean, in many ways, it's got a certain kind of complexity that you certainly don't get in the stuff right off the shelf. But I don't know if that's really my thing.
And it's not junk. It's sort of like the people who make marshmallows. I have a friend who also aspired to make the perfect marshmallow, but you know, for a s'more, it's got to be that jet puff type.
I agree. I've used homemade marshmallows for s'mores, but you don't get the same, quite the same gooey, stretchy. It's not quite the same.
It isn't. Another junk food, s'mores.
Yeah. Oh, we did s'mores on the show.
I know.
We roasted the marshmallows over Sterno cans, which, you know, it's the hobo style to it was just delightful.
Yeah. Which also brings up Rice Krispie treats, which are in the same genre of junk food, the campfire junk food.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
There is an incredible recipe out there in the Smitten Kitchen Cookbook for a salted brown butter Rice Krispie treat. And I will tell you what, if you have a place in your heart for Rice Krispie treats, you should make these.
Okay, Smitten Kitchen. I'm trying that right away. We go to downtown Seattle where Jim's been holding. Hello, Jim.
Hi, thank you. My question is regarding this thing called the Cronut that some of your listeners may be familiar with, is making a sensation in New York City. I'm curious to know, as a kind of an insight into how these things work, particularly in this day and age, what is that betting agency in London where you could place a bet on who will get dibs on the national run out of the Cronut throughout America? I mean, are we talking, will Starbucks be able to somehow corner the market on the Cronut such that you'll only be able to get the official Cronut in Starbucks, or will it be some other national chain? And I'm really keen on by the way, they had a demonstration by the baker himself on the Jimmy Fallon show one night making one of those, and they look spectacular.
Maybe we should take a – thank you for bringing up Cronuts. We're going to – we need to explain for folks who aren't in on – it's like a deep-fried croissant, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's like a hybrid croissant donut. I bet that down at Starbucks HQ in some sort of secret basement room, they are working on their Cronut analog, and you know, they call it bro nuts or something. Probably not that. That's terrible. But you know, they're thinking about it.
But that also, since that's a deep, aren't donuts deep fried?
Oh yes.
Yeah. So that there's also that whole genre of like fried Twinkies. I believe those are part of the sort of state fair Midwest fried genre of food.
Yes, my daughter said to me the other day, I think she's been to more state fairs than me, Dana, you should try a deep fried Oreo. I think you'd like it. And I was like, yeah, thanks. I think everyone would like it.
Is it the oil that makes us like it?
I think anything straight out of the deep fryer is going to be pretty good. And then like 6 minutes later, it's not.
Part of it, I think, is about the crispiness.
Yeah.
Crispy. Part of the loveliness of junk food. Mm-hmm. Crispy, greasy, salty, sweet, and sometimes salt and sweet together. I really are my new favorites.
Like kettle corn.
Kettle corn is fantastic. Yeah. Anthony in Maple Valley, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. When I was deployed to the Persian Gulf, we kind of got addicted to a Indian snack. I can preface this by saying that about 80% of the people living in the Gulf states are non-resident Indian workers, so there's a lot of Indian food in the Persian Gulf, and we called it the stuff, and the Hindi name is namkeen, and it's a mixture of nuts and dried noodles and like little pieces of cereal and extremely hot. And I guess technically you'd consider it junk food, but in reality it's pretty healthy for you because it's all natural ingredients and spices if you read the label. And you can find it in all the Indian stores in the Seattle area.
Oh, so you can still keep eating it, Anthony.
Yeah, precisely. So we thought we were getting junk food, but they pulled a fast one on us. Like I said, it actually is all healthy ingredients.
It sounds fantastic.
It does.
It does sound really good. Thanks for and what's the official name for it?
If you go to an Indian store, you can just it comes in sealable packages, kind of cellophane packages, namkeen. And it really is quite addictive, kind of like, almonds or something. You know, you have a handful and it makes you want to have more.
Thank you. That's in the genre of sort of corn nuts and
right.
Chex Mix. Did either of you ever have Chex Mix?
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Do you remember, Molly, when we did that show where we were tasting puffy snacks and we found the Indian equivalent of Cheetos?
Exactly. And they came in all sorts of different kinds of curry powder on them, and they were wonderful.
Yeah, really spicy. Mm-hmm. I think they're called kurkure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Did we order some on Amazon?
I think we may have.
And
drove to Bellevue and bought some really good, very much like Cheetos, but with genuine Indian flavors. Mm-hmm. And super addictive.
So you have just given all the culinary listeners permission to eat their favorite junk food.
There's a time and a place for everything.
Yeah. You know?
How often a week?
Oh, I don't know if we can really put parameters like that. It's a personal decision.
Okay, so listeners, I'm sorry we can't get to all of your calls, but you figure out your personal threshold and limit for junk food, and nobody will be the wiser, I guess. Molly Weisenberg, creator of Orangette. One memoir in the can, another memoir coming out next year.
Yes, next May.
Looking forward to that. And together with Matthew Amster Burton, they host the podcast Spilled Milk. And Matthew's book is out in both e and real form, right?
Ebook and paperback.
It's called Pretty Good Number One, An American Family Eats Tokyo. You can find more at his blog, Roots and Grubs. Thanks, both of you, for coming in. And so those Doritos are calling my name right now.
Thank you, Marcy.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
Oh, you know what that was. The Northwest got a thunder and lightning storm over the weekend. Our listener, Paul, stayed up late to watch the show as it passed over his house in Redmond. And amazingly, was smart enough and awake enough to grab a recorder and record that clap of thunder. Paul writes that Chief Self's spirit power was lightning, and if you listen close, you can hear him. I'm not sure we're going to hear another clap of that, but we want to know what interesting sounds you're listening to. Record 30 seconds and send it to us. I love that rain comes back around. And send us the story behind the sound. Email it to weekday@kuow.org and include sound of the day. In the subject line, coming up in the next hour of the show, we're going to talk about mapping health care and health insurance in King County. Also going to talk about one man who went to document the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and wound up involving everybody in the process. It's coming up on the show. Stay with us.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.